This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. My name is Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft is our technical director. Humans have looked to plants for relief from injury and illness for thousands of years. On the program today, we're going to explore the history of humankind's use of healing plants. We'll also take a look at current research in the field of pharmacognosy. Listeners, I welcome your telephone calls this afternoon for our guest, Stephen Foster. Together with Rebecca Johnson, he's co-author of the National Geographic Desk Reference to Nature's Medicine. Here are the phone numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Stephen Foster, lectures widely on medicinal plants. An author, photographer, and international consultant, he has 3 decades of experience in the herbal field. He is the senior author of 3 Peterson Field Guides for Identifying North American Herbs and Bioactive Plants, and a dozen more books, including Tyler's Honest Herbal and 101 Medicinal Herbs. Now let me tell you a bit more about the National Geographic Desk Reference to Nature's Medicine. It takes an in-depth look at 150 therapeutic plants from alfalfa to yohimbe. The plant profiles are arranged alphabetically by their common names. They include a description of the plant and identify its native habitat and range, as well as offer information about the plant's history and folklore. Each entry also includes a discussion of its traditional and current medicinal uses, how the plant is cultivated and propagated in current research. The profiles may also include a cautionary note. The authors say, anyone can have a reaction to a plant. They advise consulting a licensed healthcare provider before using herbs and inform your healthcare provider when you use herbs. In addition to the plant profiles, there are 9 essays about healing plants and their uses around the world. Again, the phone numbers if you'd like to talk with our guest, Stephen Foster, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Stephen Foster, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
The word pharmacognosy is a new one to me.
Well, pharmacognosy is a scientific discipline that emerged in the late 1800s to basically encompass the academic disciplines that deal with all aspects of medicines derived from nature. So in a classical sense, 100 years ago, 120 years ago, it dealt with the identity of plant drugs, looking at plants from a botanical aspect and identifying them microscopically and exploring their chemistry and their history and medicinal use and so forth. And today it's largely evolved into an academic discipline of medicinal chemistry, looking at exactly what the active components within a plant might be and then their biological activity, either from a pharmacological standpoint or a clinical standpoint. So it basically deals with sources of drugs from nature.
Mm. And one of its greatest advocates is a scholar at the University of Illinois at Chicago, Dr. Norman Farnsworth. Would you tell us a little bit about him and his interests?
Dr. Farnsworth is one of the leading researchers in medicinal plants on a worldwide basis. And the Program for Collaborative Research in Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of Illinois Chicago, Dr. Farnsworth's program, has worked in this field for many, many years. They've done projects for the WHO, the World Health Organization, and they're a WHO collaborative center in traditional medicine. They've looked at contraceptives from nature. And currently they have a National Institutes of Health grant looking at various herbal medicines that are used for mental conditions or other female-related conditions. So they're doing clinical trials on black cohosh, for example, which is a plant that occurs in the eastern U.S. that has been really a drug of choice for gynecologists in German phytomedicine for about 50 years for the treatment of menopausal symptoms.
You know, it's very interesting. In your introduction, you write about Dr. Farnsworth and this field, and you give us an introduction to the desk reference. And along the way, you tell us that this is something that surprised me, that pharmaceutical and drug companies, at the moment anyway, aren't interested in herbs. Why not?
Well, for many years, various drug companies have had research programs in natural products. And there's basically two ways of targeting natural products for research, plant medicines for research purposes. One is to do random screening of chemical substances for their biological activity. In other words, go to a region like the Amazon or tropical Africa or tropical Southeast Asia, collect as many plant species as you can and run them through screening methods, looking at perhaps diabetes models or anti-HIV models or anti-cancer models. And in doing so, in the process of random screening, there have been relatively few compounds that have been developed as drugs as a result of that screening method. Another method, however, is to use ethnobotanically targeted screening. In other words, go to those same rainforests of the Amazon or the same rainforests in tropical Africa or tropical Southeast Asia and look at how the indigenous populations use those particular drugs or plant materials for therapeutic use, and see if there might be a rational scientific basis behind that. And basically, the problem for drug companies is the economics and the complexity of that process, because pharmacognosy, by definition, requires a multidisciplinary approach to looking at plant medicine. So you have to have botanists, ethnobotanists, chemists, pharmacologists, all working in concert to do this. And most drug companies now use computer chemical modeling methods or find that they might get a lot more useful chemical information or new drug leads out of screening microbials, for example. So the interest, for one reason or another, be it complexity of science, be it politics, be it economics, drug companies, for the most part, have become disinterested in looking at new drugs from either random screening methods or ethnobotanically targeted methods.
Yeah. At the same time, though, the public's appetite for these things is huge.
It is. And I think, you know, the interest that we see now at a scientific level and also by organizations such as the National Institutes of Health are largely driven by public interest. And, you know, we can go back to the early 70s. You can almost mark it by the first Earth Day, the renewal of interest in plant medicines in the United States. And then in the early 1970s, you had herbal teas on the market. And by the late 70s, early 80s, capsulated herbs appeared. And they never fit into a neat regulatory structure during those periods of time. And then in the mid-1990s, the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act was passed, and this basically allowed these products to jump from the niche market of health and natural food stores into the mass market in the United States. And so Really, these products have been in the U.S. for about a 30 or 40-year period now, and we as a culture in the United States are really behind the curve of the rest of the world in using herbal teas and phytomedicines, well-defined herbal medicines that include all of the chemical constituents within a plant part. For example, in Germany, phytomedicine has been well established for at least 60 years. So for a lot of American medicinal plants, like echinacea, for example, the greatest market experience is in Germany, where they've been using echinacea for, about 60 years, since the late 1930s. Also in Japan, you find traditional medicines being used and part of the Japanese pharmacopoeia. And, of course, the best example over the past 25 or 30 years is China. When diplomatic relations opened up with China in the mid-1970s, at that point, acupuncture, for example, was just nothing more than almost unbelievable reports of a practitioner sticking needles in someone to treat a disease condition or even relieve pain. And now you can find acupuncturists in every state in the United States. So there's been a resurgence in interest in medicinal plants on a worldwide basis. It's not just in the United States.
This is the I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to reintroduce you and take a call.
Okay.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon, Stephen Foster, one of the authors of the National Geographic Desk Reference to Nature's Medicine. Listeners, if you have a question about herbal medicine or medicinal plants, join us with a phone call this afternoon. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. We have a listener waiting to talk with us in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Good. excuse me. How can I phrase this? Late, sometime in the 1990s, I was watching TV, the late news programs, and there was a small section on experiments that were being done on a Tibetan herb, of all things, in hospitals or a given hospital in Israel, and the herb was designed or was whatever, not designed, but was used for heart conditions, and apparently the Tibetans, according to the news thing, had used this herb for centuries for people who had heart problems from eating wrong and so forth and so forth. And I've never seen anything else on that. I've never really tried to follow it up. And I was just curious whether he deals with that in his book or is aware of that. And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. I am not aware of that particular medicine. One of the things about medicinal plant research in general is that there's so much information out there and so much research being done at this point in time. And there's about 250,000 species of higher plants that have been named, and only about 3% of those have been studied scientifically. If you look at the flora of China, which politically encompasses Tibet, there's about 30,000 plant species, and about 7,000 of them are used medicinally. And each week, I hear of some new fantastic cure for cardiac disease, or maybe cancer, or maybe AIDS, that comes from a traditional medical system somewhere in the world, and the vast majority of these are not being researched at the present time. That said, however, research interest in medicinal plants on a worldwide basis has increased tremendously over the past 15 years. In the early 1990s, someone like myself could keep up with the scientific literature on medicinal plants. You could read all the journals and at least skim the abstracts of all the articles. Now, that research information database has probably increased by 100-fold, and there's no way that one person can keep up with everything that's being published.
Hmm. Maybe this would be a good point to ask you what you can tell us about how you put this book together, you and Rebecca Johnson and the group of consultants and writers who worked with you on the book.
Well, when I worked on that book, I was looking for a miracle herbal cure that would allow me to stay awake 6 hours a day for about 3 months in a row. But we put that book together relatively quickly. We started in August of last year, and it actually went to press in early January of this year. So it was a whirlwind process, and it was a distillation of information on 150 plants, looking at their traditional use or some kind of fun facts about mythology or word origins or use origins, traditional and current medicinal uses, a little information on cultivation, plus the pertinent details on the current research on these particular medicinal plants. It was just synthesizing large amounts of data that were available to us.
Yeah, well, it's a lovely book, and it's hard to put down because it is so fascinating, and it's beautifully done with the illustrations, the photographs, the layout of the book and whatnot. I'm curious, I've got to ask you, though, now, you know, burning the midnight oil, working on this book, I in my mind's eye, I imagine you went through a lot of coffee and chocolate, which are two substances now that have been the subject of a great deal of interest and study.
Yes. Those are actually my two favorite herbs of choice, coffee and chocolate. There's been quite a bit of research done recently on the antioxidant potential of chocolate. And there's a group of compounds called flavanols that have very strong antioxidant activity. That is, they get rid of reactive oxygen species within the body by binding to free radicals and getting rid of these bad reactive oxygens that may lead to a number of disease conditions. So antioxidants have been one of the great focus areas of research in medicinal plants in the last decade or so, looking at plants with antioxidant activity. And lo and behold, one of our favorite foods or medicinal plants, if you will, chocolate, if it's processed properly so that the flavanols are not destroyed, has strong antioxidant activity.
Mm. Is there anything on the label that can lead you to say, well, this one's been processed in a way that it could be beneficial, and this one is, I'll steer clear of this one?
Well, generally on the label, no, but I believe that there are several products in the market now. Mars, for example, the mm-hmm. manufacturers of M&Ms and Snickers and so forth, if you go to their website, I think they offer several high antioxidant types of chocolate that you don't generally see in the mass market, but they are making them and they are available.
Yeah, so there are, I have seen an ad campaign for the Mars products.
Uh-huh.
And so they're trying to get us to buy and consume more
chocolate.
And I'm
sure there's others out out there, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, herbs, medicinal plants, therapeutic plants, are these terms interchangeable?
Yes, basically. You know, we like to, as human beings, categorize things and put things in, label them a certain way. And if you look at the definition of an herb or herb, it's basically any plant used for flavoring, fragrance, or medicinal qualities. So that takes in a wide range of things. A medicinal plant is, as the name implies, simply a plant used for medicine. And that might include things we call weeds and wildflowers, or garden perennials or garden annuals. Medicinal plants are all around us.
Right in our own backyard.
Yes, it's interesting if you walk out in your backyard and European immigrants to the North American continent tended to bring a lot of plants with them, either intentionally or in the cuffs of their pants or as stuffing in bags or packaging material, who knows what. Since Columbus first came to American shores or others before him, there has been a large transcontinental migration not only of people but also of plants. So in our backyards, we'll find things like dandelion. You know, we may go out and buy some type of herbicide to rid dandelion from our lawns, but dandelion is an important medicinal plant in many traditions. In fact, the leaves and the root are used as drugs in German phytomedicine. The root is used for various liver problems, and the leaves have long been used as a diuretic. That's just one example. And virtually all of the weeds that occur in our yards have some type of tradition of medicinal use, whether it's historic or modern.
Let's take another call. A listener in Chicago on line 4. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. I imagine this would also tie in somewhat with the use of all sorts of plants and even minerals with homeopathy. They've certainly had a long experience and history in utilizing all plants of various types from all over the world. And I was wondering if you could comment on that aspect, where they found it great utility in some of the applications of homeopathic methodology.
Okay, well, homeopathy is not my area of expertise, but oftentimes herbal medicine will become confused with homeopathy because homeopathy uses quite a number of plant materials in its pharmacopoeia. But basically, homeopathy is a medical modality that emerged in the late 18th century from a German physician, Samuel Hahnemann, who his basic medical theory was if you used minute potentized doses of substances that would produce a certain set of symptoms in a well person, those minute, chemically undetectable doses would cure the same set of symptoms in a well person. So it's a very complex system of medicine that's poorly understood in the U.S., but widely used in places like the U.K. and Germany. There's a separate therapeutic registration category for homeopathy. And actually, in the U.S. as well, there's a separate homeopathy.
As well as in England, I understand the royal family has praised it extensively, and as well as alternative herbal things that we can reach out to rather than the standard pharmaceutical companies promoting high price across the medicines and so forth. That nature still provides some help if we can find it out, you know.
Yes. Well, homeopathy is a well-established modality in the UK, and the royal family famously uses homeopathic physicians. It's also very well-established in India. But in the U.S., you can find a few homeopathic physicians, but they're generally few and far between.
And there are even homeopathic veterinarians. turning to more of the plant world, in South America, they've certainly come forth with a host of every type of plant in the world, from the Amazon and to other parts. And I remember the work of a Dr. Frederick Koch, who suddenly had to leave the country here because he was utilizing some of those things, and back then they didn't want to recognize it because it was, you know, somewhat competitive with the pharmaceutical companies, and wound up still practicing down there. I imagine many have found these plants, like the barks of certain trees I've heard of, being really beneficial. And so there's a lot that we're discovering way back then and continue to do so today. Well, thank you for your commentaries. I'll look for your book.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Stephen Foster, one of the authors of the National Geographic Desk Reference to Nature's Medicine. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite your questions about herbs, medicinal plants, therapeutic plants for our guest, Stephen Foster. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The desk reference takes an in-depth look at 150 therapeutic plants from alfalfa to yohimbe, and the profiles are arranged alphabetically by their common names. They include a description of the plant and identify its native habitat and range and offer information about the plant's history and folklore. And the entries also include a discussion of traditional and current medicinal uses, which brings me to ask a question about belladonna. What an interesting story.
Belladonna is a fascinating plant, and the first thing to know about belladonna is it's not something that you're going to find at your local health food store, because it is certainly a poisonous plant. It's a deadly poisonous plant, and when you look at the history of it, it's been used for witchcraft and for getting rid of witches, but also it's a storehouse of active chemical compounds such as atropine, which has been used in eye surgery for helping dilate small blood vessels, and scopolamine, another toxic alkaloid, which is used in ear patches for motion sickness, and there's just it's a chemical storehouse of biological activity, but the alkaloids themselves, which are extracted and made into prescription drugs, are highly toxic compounds, and there's an old adage in toxicology, the dose makes the poison. And certainly when you look at something like belladonna, the toxic dose is very close to the therapeutic dose, so it's always a plant that's used under medical supervision.
A long time ago, though, or relatively a long time ago, women used it in their eyes as a kind of I guess you could call it a cosmetic.
Yes, to dilate the pupil.
And that was thought to make you more attractive, and I do believe that there have been studies done that show a dilated pupil is a sign of being attracted or being aroused.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Well, I believe that's correct. We have a couple of callers who would like to talk with you, Stephen Foster. Let's go next to a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. I just had a quick question, kind of comment. I've been using tart cherry juice. Actually, I'm using the capsules for arthritis, and you talked about the flavonoids, and I think tart cherry juice is high in that as well. And I wondered if you could comment on the use of cherry juice for, or cherry extract from the tart cherries for arthritis.
Okay. Many often inflammatory activity or any inflammatory activity is related to antioxidant activity. And there's a number of fruits like the sour cherry and also blueberries and bilberry from Europe, which have high antioxidant activity. And often in an arthritic condition, generally speaking, that antioxidant activity may translate into anti-inflammatory activity and hence relief for arthritic conditions.
I found it very beneficial, and I just wondered if there was more to it than just the advertising.
Well, that's an interesting question. There is scientific research on antioxidant activity of some of the components. I'm not familiar with the research on sour cherry off the top of my head, but you have to be a little careful when you go to the Internet as a source of information. Sometimes I think of WWW when it comes to herbal information as the worldwide wasteland. Because it's where anybody can, quote-unquote, publish whatever they wish without peer review or editorial review, and you've really got to corroborate your sources, and oftentimes even the scientific literature is conflicting on one herb to another. So, and the Internet tends to be a place where there's a lot of hype. Herbal medicines, and somehow herbal cures attract hype from people trying to sell or promote a product that may not have a lot of scientific information. So, you know, you have to look for balanced information. And if you have a website that supplies no scientific research on the claim, but has lots of testimonials about the claim, that would be a red flag for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I can just give you an example of something that happened today. In August of 2003, the planet Mars was at its closest point to the Earth in like 50,000 years. It won't be this close, that close again for another 50,000 years. Well, in August 2004, I received emails from people saying, look at Mars. It's going to be as close to the Earth as it's going to be in 50,000 years. And in 2005, I received similar emails. And today, I received an email saying, look at Mars in 2006. It'll be as large as the moon. Well, not true. This event occurred in 2003. Yet, somebody picks this up on the Internet and sends it along without paying attention to a simple thing like
Yeah,
you have to be cautious.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for the call. Let's talk with another listener, a listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Foster. Could you take up the question of Japanese chlorella, which I use on a regular basis, and as far as a natural detoxifier, cellular energy, protein and natural enzyme source, immune booster. I found nothing better than this. And there's a bunch of other things I'd throw at you, but other listeners have other questions, and I'll let you go with chlorella. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Chlorella is a microorganism, an algae, that is in the category of what's often sold as green foods. And There are others in the same category, like spirulina and a number of other one-cell microalgae, and there's a host of health benefits that are claimed for these various substances, along with a fairly decent body of scientific literature. But there again, you have to be careful to sort out the hype from the science, and I suspect that the caller knows a lot more about chlorella than I do.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Stephen Foster, our guest this afternoon, one of the authors of the National Geographic Desk reference to Nature's Medicine. We have about 7-8 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join us, give us a call. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. A lot of interest these days in tea. And this is something that goes back thousands of years, another fascinating story. Would you talk about tea with us?
Sure. You know, it used to be 20 years ago in America, you could get black tea, and black tea was black tea, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's a lot of interest on what used to be called tannins, now broken down into finer categories, chemical categories, anthocyanidins, that once again have strong antioxidant activity. And there have been numerous studies in recent years on not only green tea, but also black tea. And black tea is, it's all from the same source plant, Camellia sinensis. And black tea becomes black because of a fermentation process after it's harvested. And now we're seeing products called white tea. And white tea, which is supposed to be very high in the active chemical constituents in tea, actually is the little tiny leaf buds, and they pick those leaf buds individually and then dry those, so it tends to be very expensive and a little more difficult to find. But there are many different categories of tea depending upon how it's processed and how it's harvested and where it's grown. I have a friend who's a tea aficionado, and he buys tea that's like $200 a pound from China.
Wow.
And he steeps it not like for 10 minutes like most of us do our tea, but he steeps it only for about 10 seconds just to infuse the volatile compounds within the tea leaf. And he claims that it provides greater focus for his mind. So he's not looking for the caffeine or related central nervous system stimulant alkaloids in tea, or for the antioxidant compounds, but looking for the nuances of volatile components that that he believes improves his mental capacity.
Wow. $200 a pound. I hope he gets a lot of...
He only uses a little bit.
A little goes a lot.
Yeah,
I guess it would be like saffron or something, I suppose, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting. In the sidebar for the entry for tea, the book contains a little information about how this goes back 5,000 years ago to a Chinese emperor by the name of Shen Nong. And it sounds like, at least according to legend, he was a pretty smart guy. He had a scientific mind. This is from the book. Shen Nong had a scientific mind and a health-conscious attitude. One of his edicts required that all drinking water be boiled in order to prevent disease. So from there, where do we get tea? Well, one summer day, while visiting part of his kingdom, or so the story goes, Shen Nong and his attendants stopped to rest. In accordance with his ruling, the servants began to boil water to drink, setting up their cooking fire near a tall bush with glossy green leaves. A puff of wind dislodged several dried leaves clinging to the bush's branches, and they fell into the boiling water. And there, the birth of tea.
So if you ever wondered how people began using a plant, you can think of it as legend rather than trial and error of ancient man tasting a leaf, and if he died, his friends decided it was poisonous. If he got well, they decided it was a medicinal plant. Often it's a little more complex.
Yeah. It is interesting also to think about. One of the things that stood out for me as I paged through the book, so many of these plants are found well beyond their indigenous habitat, and we talked about that a little bit, or you did a little bit earlier. And, you know, trade and travel have played a tremendous role also in the globalization of these plants. So, you know, the things that we have growing in our backyards in the Midwest are not native, or many of them are not native, but have come from other corners of the world.
I think in Illinois, something like something close to 30% of the plants that grow around you in Illinois are actually from somewhere else originally. And sometimes this is a good thing and sometimes a bad thing.
Right.
Most often a bad thing when plant does not have a natural competitor like Japanese honeysuckle or kudzu in the south. And I've often thought that for these serious weeds, maybe the best way to control them is to find a way to use them. Japanese honeysuckle, for example, it's called Jin Yinhua in China, which means gold and silver flower. And when the flowers first come out, they're silver-colored, the next day they're gold-colored. But Japanese honeysuckle is one of the primary treatments for upper respiratory tract infections in China. Here we consider it a useless weed. Why not do some work on its chemistry and pharmacology? Mm. It may reveal treasures that are yet unknown.
Yeah. We have to wrap up now, but before we go, we're about to go to find out what happened today with the soybean contract prices. So why don't we finish up with a little discussion about soybeans. The soybean is here in the desk reference to Nature's Medicine.
Soybean we think of as a food plant. In China, it would have primarily been thought of as a medicinal plant.
Mm-hmm.
And soybeans today are recognized for a number of compounds called phytoestrogens, such as diazidine, which seems in epidemiological studies to favor chemo prevention, that is, the prevention of cancer in various populations in Asia who have high amounts of soybeans in their diet. And there's, if you go do an internet search on scientific literature on soybeans, it's now voluminous in terms of its potential for health benefits.
Yeah, fascinating field. The field of pharmacognosy. And our thanks this afternoon to Stephen Foster. Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Stephen Foster is one of the authors of the National Geographic Desk reference to Nature's Medicine, the publisher, National Geographic.